February 7, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. President Barack Obama yesterday addressed about 3,500 attendees at the National Prayer Breakfast. The annual event is a very important part of official Washington. At least, it's treated as an official part because it generally draws not only the President of the United States, but many other high elected and appointed officials as well. This is an exercise in America's civil religion. It is a religious event, not so much explicitly a Christian event. There have been high-profile Christian speakers in the past, and most of the attendees are undoubtedly Christian. But the main speaker at this event, other than the president, was a Hindu, and the president himself spoke an unusually strong word on the issue of religious liberty. As Sarah Pulliam Bailey reported for Religion News Service, quote, facing criticism that he does not give religious freedom enough attention, President Obama devoted most of his National Prayer Breakfast address to the issue, naming people in prison for their beliefs and calling out specific nations. Indeed, the president did single out as particularly oppressive North Korea and Iran. He said, and I quote, "We pray for Kenneth Bay, a Christian missionary who's been held in North Korea for 15 months, sentenced to 15 years of hard labor." The president also said, quote, "We pray for Pastor Saeed Abedini. He's been held in Iran for more than 18 months, sentenced to 8 years in prison on charges relating to his Christian beliefs," end quote. In other comments, the president grounded his concern for religious liberty in the nature of every single human being as made in God's image. He said, quote, "We believe that each of us is wonderfully made in the image of God. We therefore believe in the inherent dignity of every human being, dignity that no earthly power can take away, and central to that dignity is freedom of religion," end quote. The president deserves our gratitude and appreciation for striking such a clear note on the issue of religious liberty, and for using an event of such a high platform and profile in order to do this. He also deserves our appreciation for mentioning those two Christians held respectively by North Korea and Iran. And he also deserves credit for making such a clear argument grounded in the Imago Dei, that is, in the image of God, in which every single human being is made. The president went on in the course of his remarks to defend the religious liberty of those who have no faith. And in post-Christian or perhaps even post-secular America, in the religious confusion of the 21st century, the president was also in the rather confusing position of speaking so clearly on behalf of religious liberty in the nations of the world while being charged here in the United States with violating religious liberty in terms of his own Obamacare health mandate, the contraception mandate that is soon to be before the United States Supreme Court for oral arguments and eventual determination by that court later this year. In her report for Religion News Service on the event, Sarah Pulliam Bailey wrote, quote, "Obama's address was perhaps the most robust presidential statement on international religious freedom in U.S. history." She was there quoting Judd Birdsall, a former U.S. diplomat who writes and speaks on religious freedom. She went on to offer an extended quote from Birdsall in which he said, quote, "It's clear that the president views religious liberty not as an isolated, nice-to-have human right, but as a national security priority that is intimately tied to a range of foreign policy objectives." He went on to say, "The challenge for Obama now is to quickly nominate a qualified religious freedom ambassador and to demonstrate some tangible, meaningful successes in his religious freedom agenda," end quote. Now, with all deference to President Obama and this address, it's not clear that Mr. Birdsall's statement is actually sustained by reality. President Obama did offer a very clear call for religious liberty. Indeed, he made a very specific argument on behalf of religious liberty. But so have presidents in the past, presidents including, for instance, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We should remember that it was President Jimmy Carter and his administration in the late 1970s who made extraordinary efforts, very personal efforts of personal presidential diplomacy, to free pastors, Christian pastors, especially in the Soviet Union, suffering oppression and jail sentences there. One of the most famous of those pastors was a Baptist pastor by the name of Georgi Vins. And shortly after his release from the Soviet Union, a release personally brokered by President Carter, Pastor Vins came to Samford University where I was a student, and I had the opportunity to share breakfast with him. In that conversation, through an interpreter, it was very clear that Pastor Vings believed that it was the personal intervention of President Jimmy Carter that explained, and humanly speaking, was the only explanation for why he was released from the Soviet Union and found himself honored in the United States. we can only pray that the two Christians mentioned by name by President Obama, those Christians imprisoned in North Korea and Iran, may soon also be released and find their way back to the United States. That might take the same kind of personal presidential diplomacy that was demonstrated by President Carter during his administration. If President Obama is to be successful in the release of the two Christians he mentioned during the prayer breakfast, it might well take the very same kind of very personal presidential diplomacy. We can only pray that those efforts will be successful. Next, we shift to controversy concerning the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. A panel of that convention recently interrogated leaders of the Roman Catholic Church about the priestly sex abuse scandal in that church worldwide. That received a good deal of attention when the hearings were taking place. But earlier this week, the United Nations group released its report, and that has also garnered a great deal of international attention. At first glance, as was expected, the United Nations group was pressing the Roman Catholic Church, especially its leadership in Rome, to make very clear that sex abuse is simply unacceptable under any circumstances, to put structures in place to protect children at every level and in every region, and to make very clear that child sexual abuse is a crime under every circumstance and is to be reported by every responsible person when it is even merely suspected. Those were things we expected from the United Nations group. That's the kind of advice and counsel you'd expect from any kind of very responsible group dealing with the problem of child sexual abuse. But the amazing thing about the report that came out earlier this week is that it did not stop at making very clear suggestions of its expectations of how the Roman Catholic Church would act to protect children. It went far further than that, and that's where it should have especially the attention of every religious body anywhere in the world. Because when religious liberty is very much the issue, we should recognize that in this body's report, religious liberty is very much at stake, and in a way that might be rather unexpected. But then again, we are talking about a body of the United Nations. Its overreach, maybe, should actually be expected. But the overreach in this case is absolutely huge. As the New York Times reports, quote, "The report addressed issues far beyond child sexual abuse, taking the Vatican to task for its opposition to contraception, homosexuality, and abortion in cases of child rape and incest. The committee even suggested that the Church amend its canon laws to permit abortions for pregnant girls whose lives and health are at risk," end quote. That was from the New York Times, as was reported on Thursday. But I actually got a copy of the report from the United Nations, and looking at the report, what's amazing is how much further even than the report in the New York Times, the report actually takes its condemnation of the Roman Catholic Church and its interference in the Church's theological and moral teachings. Of concern to all of us should be the fact that a United Nations body has more or less demanded that the Roman Catholic Church change its teachings, shift its convictions and beliefs on crucial issues of moral importance. For instance, reading directly from the report released earlier this week, I read, quote, "While also noting as positive the progressive statement delivered in July 2013 by Pope Francis, the committee is concerned about the social stigmatization of and violence against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender adolescents and children raised by same-sex couples," end quote. Now, what the report goes on to make very clear is that the Church's teaching is considered to be oppressive, and the stigmatization is basically rooted just in the moral judgment, biblical and moral judgments, made by the Church concerning sexual sin. There's more. The committee also called upon the Vatican to, quote, "overcome all the barriers and taboos surrounding adolescent sexuality that hinder their access to sexual and reproductive information, including on family planning and contraceptives." The committee went on to suggest that the Church should, quote, "review its position on abortion with a view to identifying the circumstances under which access to abortion services can be permitted," end quote. To figure out how all this works, we're indebted to Emma Green reporting for The Atlantic. She asked the question, "So if a UN committee finds Church teachings to violate the human rights of children, what can it do to the Holy See?" The short answer, she says, is nothing. She goes on to quote Julian Koo, a professor at Hofstra University School of Law, who said, quote, "There's no legal obligation under the treaty to follow the recommendations of the committee. The committee itself is formed by the treaty, and it's just housed at the United Nations." At that point, Green explains, "That doesn't mean the body's findings aren't influential, though." Koo went on to say, quote, "The primary power committee members have is to release this report and get it picked up by activists and the media. To the extent there are groups that can pressure picture of the Holy See, they can use this report to say, look, you failed in this respect. Ku, by the way, went on to say that the committee is made up of people who are, quote, academics, nonprofit leaders, and sometimes activists. But it should probably come as very small relief, if any relief at all to us, that this body of the United Nations has no power to enforce its dictates. The report I hold in my hands right now from the United Nations is official. It comes directly from the body, and it says it is the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, Committee on the Rights of the Child, Observations on the Second Periodic Report of the Holy See. In other words, it is the United Nations presuming, in terms of its own official statement, to render a religious and theological judgment upon the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. The point is clearly this. It's the Roman Catholic Church today. It could be any church or denomination tomorrow. What right has the United Nations, any body of the United Nations, to demand in public on United Nations stationery that a church change its moral teachings? This is an arrogance that is unprecedented in terms of international relations, and yet it is an arrogance that has largely gone unnoted by the international media. Where are the alarms that should be going off loudly among all those who are concerned for the preservation of religious liberty? This is a massive and inexcusable overreach and arrogance demonstrated by the United Nations. As I said, the alarm should be going off loudly for all those who are concerned for religious liberty. But on the other hand, perhaps we need to recognize that the United Nations, even if it is arrogant and overreaching, is also, and for this I guess we should be thankful, incompetent. That point was made very clear in a column that appeared in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, written by historian Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts writes this, and I quote, "As a young man 30 years ago, I used to fear that the United Nations might, in my lifetime, pose a threat to the nation-state. A uniglobal, world government movement that promised to abolish war might, I worry, destroy national sovereignty in the name of an amorphous appeal to the brotherhood of man or our common humanity." But then he goes on to write, "Yet having attended last week's Security Council open debate on universal peace," the full title of the meeting was War, Its Lessons, and the Search for a Permanent Peace, "I now realize that my fears were completely unfounded. The UN not only couldn't organize universal peace, I suspect that the denizens of Turtle Bay," that's the area in Manhattan where the United Nations headquarters building is located, "I suspect," he says, "that the denizens of Turtle Bay don't even really want it," end quote. Now, Andrew Roberts just happens to be one of my favorite historians, and I noted with interest that the British historian had gone to this event at the United Nations. He wrote about those who were gathered there representing so many nations, considering peace, the mandate for peace, and trying to learn from the origins of World War I how such an international military conflict might be avoided. But as Andrew Roberts makes very clear, what became very evident in this United Nations meeting is that those who were sitting around the table couldn't agree on what caused World War I. They could agree on one thing. They each wanted to blame the other for being a threat to world peace. Andrew Roberts concluded his essay with these words, quote, "To judge by the United Nations treatment of the opportunity for an intelligent and enlightening debate about the lessons of war, the pattern isn't going to change anytime soon. I no longer fear the danger of world government or hold out much hope for universal peace after seeing the way the world behaves when it's talking to itself," end quote. But my corrective to Andrew Roberts is this. Even though the United Nations might be incompetent, history reveals that incompetent overreach is often a very deadly issue. To have an official United Nations committee demand that the Roman Catholic Church change its theological and moral teachings should be a warning to us all. But quite frankly, as the week comes to an end and we're considering weird stories that come with serious warnings, we have to add one more to the mix. The Telegraph of London reported on Wednesday, and I quote, "A British magistrate has issued an extraordinary summons to the worldwide leader of the Mormon Church, alleging that its teachings about mankind amount to fraud." The reporter John Bingham went on to write, "Theodore S. Monson, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has been ordered to appear at Westminster Magistrates Court in London next month to defend the Church's doctrines, including beliefs about Adam and Eve and Native Americans. The formal summons, signed by District Judge Elizabeth Roscoe, warns Mr. Monson, who is recognized by Mormons as God's prophet on earth, that a warrant for his arrest could be issued if he fails to make the journey from Salt Lake City, Utah, for a hearing on March 14th. As Bingham goes on to report, in one of the most unusual documents ever issued by a British court, it lists seven teachings of the Church, including that Native Americans are descended from a family of ancient Israelites, as possible evidence of fraud," end quote. Now, as I warned, this is one of the weirdest stories I've encountered in a long time. But I'm not talking about it because it's weird. I'm talking about it because it represents a very clear and present danger to religious liberty. We must keep ever in mind that religious liberty must be defended for all if it is to exist for any. That's why we have proper concern for this threat to the integrity of the Roman Catholic Church and the United Nations, and the attack upon the liberty of Mormonism by an English magistrate court. Both of these, though weird, are very ominous and truly significant. Both deserve our attention. When it comes to Mormonism, quite frankly, Christians look at the Book of Mormon, the various Mormon writings, and the total superstructure of Mormon theology, and recognize that it is absolutely incredible. That is to say, totally lacking in biblical credibility. But that is not to say that we do not stand steadfastly for the religious liberty of Mormons. We cannot stand by and fail to defend the religious liberty of Mormons if we intend to claim it for ourselves. And when we look at this incursion into the belief system of the Mormon Church, our right to disagree with Mormonism, to engage in a theological debate and a contest of apologetics with Mormonism, that's an issue of both religious liberty and Christian responsibility. But to have a secular court demand that the leader of that religious body appear in the court to defend its teachings against charges of fraud, that is so far over the line, even most British legal authorities believe that the summons will be thrown out of court. But as in so many cases, having it merely thrown out of court is insufficient. The fact that a summons was ever granted by a court summoning a religious leader to defend those religious teachings in court, that is unacceptable on its face and should now be a matter of extreme embarrassment in terms of the British system of justice. So as the week comes to an end, we find ourselves hearing the United States President make a very eloquent statement on behalf of religious liberty at the very time that religious liberty is imperiled by the United Nations with respect to the Roman Catholic Church and by a magistrate court in London when it comes to Mormonism. This week, we found ourselves discussing on Friday developments that we could hardly believe would be possible even just this past Monday. It's been quite a week. There will no doubt be plenty to discuss next week, including the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. Remember that tomorrow morning, the next installment of Ask Anything Weekend Edition will be released. To call with your question for an upcoming program, just call and leave the question in your voice at 877-505-2058. That's 1-877-505-2058. Ask Anything Weekend Edition, released tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and on Sunday I'll be speaking at High Point Baptist Church in Austin, Texas. Perhaps I'll have the opportunity to see some of you there. Until then, I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.